Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, a broadcast of the EPI, the Ethical Persuasion Institute, which I'll have up and going sometime in 2023. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques, social issues, politics, everything's gotten broken. It's time to turn up our game, learn how to talk to each other better, and see if we can still get things done. And I suggest we do that with learning rhetoric. And my further suggestion is using ethical only rhetoric. And so that's the goal of the podcast, is to start that process. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, late night comedy writer, former stand-up. Well, I kind of still do stand-up. I'm supposed to start doing cruise ships at some point. I don't know. I'm the founder of Rhetoric Warriors and the Ethical Persuasion Institute. Do three things here. I talk to comedians about politics and their careers. I uncensor them. Very interesting public speakers. Secondly, I convert conservatives on here. If you know conservatives, you think they need converting, send them to me, and I will you know, use techniques on them, and they'll still be happy about it. They won't even mind it. And I talk to persuasion pros, social issue luminaries, people who are in the middle of social issues, and straight up rhetoricians. I have more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast you'll listen to today. That's my main promise. So today's guest, I would say social issue luminary, and I'm sure he's an informal rhetorician. Like, we've already talked a little bit, and I'm sure he understands a lot about what he's doing, and he works on his messaging in order to make it effective. And he's had a very unique role. And some people get into these roles that are available in these massive social issues. And his is gun violence. In 2018, he wrote a Facebook post titled, "I Was Almost a School Shooter," I think is the title exactly. I'm not sure, but I think that's it. It went viral. And when school shootings happened, most recently in Uvalde, he's back in the conversation and in a really interesting way. And I want to talk to him about that. From being inside that personal, societal, political, philosophical storm. Aaron Stark.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for having me on. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing this at the end of your day. It's like 9 o'clock where you are, and you have what, 4 kids?
Yeah, I do. I have 4 kids. Only 2 live with me now, though. 2 older ones that are on their own. So.
Okay.
And the 2 that are with me are almost teenagers already. One's already a teenager, one's almost there. So they're pretty much self-sustaining. It's easy.
All right. So you're not still reading bedtime stories to them?
No diaper changes in my house, thankfully.
So let's get started. I mean, you've been on the media a lot lately. Tell everybody just the background of your story. You can go and check it out. Like, the one I found you through was CNN, Dana Brown, I think, is that her name? Interviewed you, and I thought it was excellent, and the way that you talked about this was excellent. But just take us through the highlights of the stories for people who've never heard of you.
Absolutely. So my story is that you're right, I did start with a Facebook post that I was almost a school shooter. I grew up in a really violent and aggressive house. I had a very, very toxic upbringing from birth to 5. I describe it like living in a Stephen King movie. All the extreme abuse you can imagine, sexual, physical, mental, seeing my mom get raped in front of me, just absolute horrible things. And then that transitioned at about 5 years old, when my mom left my birth father, to something more akin to Scarface, where it was crack cocaine and violence and crime. And it was along that time, I was the fat, dirty, smelly one. I was the nothing kid. I was told I was worthless a lot by everybody in my life. And when you're told you're worthless a lot, you will believe it. And then eventually you'll try to do everything you can to make everybody else agree with you. And during that time, as I was growing up, mind you, I'm about 10, 11 years old, I start to get really toxic and I start to get really aggressive. And I'm also dirty and smelly and filthy. I went to like 40 different schools. We were very nomadic. I never stayed at a school longer than 6 months. We were constantly running from the authorities, running from social workers, there were multiple times in my life where I had a duffel bag thrown at me at 4 o'clock in the morning saying, grab all your stuff, we need to get out of here. And the only thing I would ever grab was my comic books. So I was a huge fan of superhero comic books. I still am. That was my escape. And that, as I turned into a teen, that toxic personality that I was giving off got my, it got me bullied a lot at a lot of all the different schools I was going to. There was a lot of different bullies. They would do stuff like throw, dump food on my head, act like they were shooting me with a harpoon, like I was a whale, just tried to degrade me in all different ways. And then it was happening at home a lot too, just abuse everywhere that I was at. And it turned into my personality. And I, as I become a teenager, 13, 14 years old, I really started to embrace that darkness and that toxicity as my own self. I kind of wrapped it around myself like a blanket and used it as a shield, both to keep those who disagreed with me away, or that thought I was ugly away, and attract the very few who could see through that shield. And I would, the abuse at home just would getting worse and worse. The people digging for crack rock in my carpet and fighting with each other and stabbing each other with the inside of a doorknob. If you ever take apart a doorknob and look at the inside gears, never use that as a weapon. That's very dangerous. I've watched my mom stab my stepdad in the gut with that. So that violence at home just got so bad. I couldn't live at home anymore. I ended up homeless at about 15 years old, and I started cutting myself. It was the only emotion I could really, that was mine at the time. I described what I was living at that age, like a tsunami of pain and anguish just kind of sloshing over me, but I didn't really have any agency over what I was, where I was living. It was just, I was dealing with all the different stimuli of the adults around me, but I was trying to find my own footing. And the only way I could, when I cut myself, it gave me a sense of normalcy, like a reality in a way. And so I, during that time, it's important to note that around 10 years old, I met a friend. And his name was Mike. And Mike lived basically the opposite life of mine. He had very loving and caring family. Their parents still live in that same house to this day. It's that they supported and nurtured. He got to go to art school and college and all these different fun things and vacations and all the different family fun things that I always wanted, he got to do. And when I was nomadic going from house to house, his was always home base. His place was, he never moved. So his place was the stable one. So I memorized his phone number. And so when I was in that darkest of my depression, I basically ended up living in his shed behind his house. That was, ended up being my home base. And one night, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. I was pouring down rain. I was in his shed on this puffy gray chair. This big recliner, those cobwebs and dirt on the ceiling, the roofs had like gaps in it and slits. It was pouring down rain. And I'm cutting myself so bad that a pool of blood is forming underneath me. And I think I need to do something or I'm going to die. And so the next morning I got up and I knocked on his mom's back door and I called social services on myself. And I set an appointment for later that afternoon. It was like 7 o'clock when I set the appointment. The meeting was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And by the time I got there, they didn't just bring me in. They also brought my mom in. And I sat down and I produced a bloody razor blade. It was a big square razor blade, like a box cutter. And I threw it on the table, showed him my arms and said, I feel like I'm at the bottom. I feel like I'm nothing. I feel like there's nothing for me at all. And my mom, who was the most practiced liar I've ever known, she managed to move into like 40 or 50 different houses as we bounced around from place to place, constantly getting evicted, and knew how to navigate authorities very, very well. She got them to believe that I was making it all up, that I was just doing it for attention. And they sent me home with her. And as they sent me home with her, we got about 2 blocks from the building, and she turned to me with a snarl on her face and said, next time you should do a better job and I'll buy you the razor blades. And I just, okay, you want to see a monster? I'll show you that now. And I just dove headlong into that dark. And I kind of went on now what I call a scorched earth phase. For like the next 9 months, I was just burning down every bit of support that I had. Every bit of, if you thought that I was nice, I'd prove that you were wrong. I would figure out how to be as toxic and evil to you as possible. And I was nasty and mean and personal and just ugly with my toxicity. And during that time, I also went into every family member's house I could and broke into their house, or didn't really break in. I kind of charmed my way in and snuck into their photo albums and burned every picture of me that I could. So I gathered all the pictures of me before 15 years old and just burned them. And my brother managed to save like 2 or 3. My girlfriend at the time managed to save 2 or 3, but I just burned it all. And I say I had a girlfriend because at the time I actually wasn't as alone as you might think. I didn't have friends, but I had what you would call disaster groupies. That's what I call them now. And because they were kind of like living vicariously through my damage. They just wanted to, they didn't really have anything like me in their life. And they kind of wanted to experience that dark side for themselves. And they, but they all had nice homes to go home to. And I didn't. And so it was more like a bunch of depressed kids navigating depression without a rudder and without adult supervision. But in that time, when I had those disaster group friends, when we would sit and we would talk, instead of talking about fantasy football or girls or sports, we'd talk about killing people. We'd talk about, if you're going to kill 10 people, what would you do? If you're going to kill 20 people, what would you do? And so that just kind of became the fiction of the group. And so those ideas kind of festered as I swirled in that dark. And then after about 9 months of that toxic scorched earth time, I ended up completely alone. I was in the field behind Casa Bonita. If you ever watched that TV show, South Park did a whole episode on Casa Bonita. That's that episode, or it was that restaurant. So I was in the field behind there. And I was at the bottom. I hadn't changed. I didn't have socks on, but I hadn't taken my shoes off in like 3 weeks. And my feet were literally rotting off my body. I hadn't changed my clothes in months at that point. I was surviving off of free samples out of the grocery store and living off of washing myself in their sink and then evading the police until I could make it to the school grounds in the afternoon. And I was just absolutely at the bottom, had no more support left. And I thought, if I don't do something, I'm going to die. And so I knew that last time when I had warned them, they called my mom in, so I wasn't going to do that again. And so across the street from where I went to school, that Anomaly went to school. I had to be at school, otherwise you'd get arrested for truancy. So I was enrolled in North High here in Denver. And while I'm sorry, I lost my place. What was the last thing I said that?
You were not going to school to avoid truancy.
Oh, yeah. So I as I go into that dark spot, I knew that across the street from my high school, there was a building that said mental health. Okay. And I couldn't really remember what else was on it. Just said mental health. And I knew that I wasn't going to warn them. So I just showed up cold, knocked on the door, said, "Hey, I need some assistance." And I don't really remember that conversation. I just remember the end of it, because the young lady in early 20s, she answered, and the only thing I really remember her saying was what she said at the end was that, "I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. I can't help you." And as I walked out of that door, my brain just shattered. It just broke. And it literally felt like a mirror breaking. And I discovered what was underneath that hurricane. That underneath that giant tsunami of pain I was living in, if you go all the way to the bottom, it gets really quiet and it gets really still. Because if you don't have anything left to live for, then you don't have anything left to lose. And like, what are you going to do? You're going to cut my arm off? I'll die. You're going to put me in jail? Okay, maybe they'll feed me. You know what? There's no more down. And right there, all my plans got crystallized. I knew exactly what I was going to do. I was going to get a gun. I knew where to get a gun because there was gangbangers went to the school. It was mid-90s. Gangs were prevalent. And then these guys took guns to the school all the time and flashed pistols and stuff and talked about having rifles. They sold drugs to my family and they knew that I wasn't a narc. I kind of like lived around the school. And so I went to them like, "Hey, can you get me a gun? Hopefully one that shoots a lot of bullets." I'm like, "Yeah, sure. Give me one. Give me 3 days or give me an ounce of weed." I'm like, "Okay." That was an easy part. Went to my friend, stole an ounce of weed off my brother's friends who was sleeping on my mom's floor. I went to her house and stole that out of his pocket. And mind you, this is 90s, so that was like $300. Okay. And so I give it to that, and that sets to get the gun. And I knew where I was going to go was either the school or the mall food court. And the only difference in the target would have been the time of day I got the weapon. The targets actually were rather incidental. To be honest, that the people I would have killed weren't really the targets. The targets were my parents. I wanted to make them deal with creating a monster. And both places weren't what we would consider soft targets. It's important to note that neither one of those places were soft targets. The school had armed uniform police officers stationed in at all times. And the mall had a police station near, literally a couple doors down from the food court. My plan had included suicide by cop in the plan. And so I was set. I was going to get the gun and kill a lot of people. And so looking at that, looking back now, I didn't realize it then, but looking back now, I think I was saying goodbye. I think I was going to the people that I cared about and was closing off relationships in a much more positive way than before, like giving away my things and trying to say my true feelings to people and like just not nearly as toxic as before. Kind of dropped all that. And during that time, I went to Mike's house. And when Mike opened the door, he didn't know what I had planned, but he saw the hell that I had been living in. It was his shed that I was sleeping in during those times. It was, he had been sneaking me out dinners into his shed the whole time. Like I had cut myself in his bedroom before. He had seen the pain. The whole time I was his friend, we'd been friends since we were 12. I was 12 and he was 10. Now I'm 16. That whole 4 years, I had never once took him to my house. He never went and spent the night at my house. We never went and had dinner, hung out at my house at all because of the violence over there all the time. So he knew the hell I was living in. And he brought me in and he saw, he kept on telling me I was a good kid in the shit world. I don't know if we can cuss on this podcast, but.
Hey, you can say whatever you want.
Okay. He's like, I'm a good kid in the shit world is what he would tell me. And he sat me down, gave me a meal, gave me a shower and treated me like I was a person. And at the time I didn't human. I felt like I was just a ball of destruction. I felt like I was just walking death. And him treating me that way was kind of like, it kind of like set my feet down back on the ground, like a splash of cold water in my face. And he stopped me from committing an atrocity. And I stayed at his house for a week and a half and I never went and got the gun. And he is still my best friend to this day. And my entire message is that we need to give love to the ones that we feel deserve it the least because they need it the most. That one that's in the dark, instead of pushing him out and further into the dark by thinking he's a threat, look at him like he might be a friend, like you might be able to bring him closer to you and back into the light. Because at the heart of it, I really think we're all just craving to be told we're okay.
It's quite a story, man.
Thank you. So that's my story. Now, coming out of my story, that is its own story. So the day after the Parkland massacre, I wrote a Facebook post. And it was literally because we were watching the news. And I was watching, in particular, a news report of a reporter was interviewing a student who had just left the school. This was in a video from the day before. And the kid was covered in, had blood splattered on them from the shooting. And the reporter was asking something like, how do you feel? And I just was enraged. Like, that is the most depersonalizing, dehumanizing stuff. How could you say that? How could you, what do you think the kid feels like? Like, what kind of stupid question is that? And so I went back, sat on the toilet, and literally wrote a Facebook post about my story. And when I came out, my wife and my daughter had read it. We sat and had a really tearful discussion about it for the next 4 hours or so, because my wife only knew about 40% of my story. My daughter only knew about 20%. And so it was full disclosure day for dad. And so we talked about all that. And then the next day, my Facebook post kind of went like slightly Facebook viral. And so my wife's like, hey, maybe Kyle Clark might want to see it. He's a local news reporter here in Denver. He has a show called Next on 9 News. And we watch the show all the time. And so I sent it to him over Twitter. And the very next day, there was a camera crew at my house filming me read the Facebook post. And that got 17 million views. And in a week. And so I went from dude sitting on my couch playing video games, being depressed, thinking that this was a millstone, that if anybody ever found out about it, they'd hate me, to all of a sudden I'm getting hit with messages from all over the planet of not just, hey, that's cool, but hey, that's cool. And here's everything that ever happened to me. And here's all my pain. And so it's just been the most cathartic, life-changing experience. I've got to do some amazing things just by talking about my pain. And if somehow me talking about the darkest point of my life can help even one person see that there's a way out of it for them, then I'm going to keep talking till I don't have a voice.
Yeah, that's got to feel.
I ramble. So
that is absolutely perfect. I wanted to hear your story. I wanted to hear it as you tell it. You know, I don't want to jump in, and that's the nice thing about podcasts is I don't need to cut you into, you know, sound bites and things like mm-hmm. that. I think you're very good at sound bites. I've watched you on interviews where you've worked on telling this story enough to where you know the points that hit, and you've got some scripted lines in a good way, you know, that you've mm-hmm. thought about, and I think it comes across really well.
Thank you.
Very authentic about this.
Well, here's the thing is that if you've ever watched any of my videos or my TED Talk, I've never written any of this down. I never wrote my TED Talk down. I never wrote any of my presentations down. I don't prepare my speeches. I didn't prepare for this podcast besides sitting here playing a video game. I literally watched the hearings on the January 6th hearings and then took a shower and put my kids to bed and then came and found the podcast. Like I feel that this is just my life. The only thing I can do is open up my heart to the world and hopefully share it. And I just pick a point and start. The only reason why it sounds repetitive and scripted is just because it's literally my life and I can't really change it. If I changed it, that'd be unauthentic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not to me like scripted. And when I say that, it's not negative at all. It means, like I said, you've worked out the way that you think about this. And, you know, so that you come back to it again and again, because it's the most authentic, best way to express it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things about rhetoric. You know, I have a PhD in rhetoric, and it's what I do for a living, and it's a formal study, you know, everybody gives that a certain status, but everybody's a natural rhetorician. Everybody's got sort of dedicated ways of giving out information and communicating in their best. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you clearly have a lot of communication skill. You're clearly, like I said, very earnest and very well spoken about it.
Well, thank you. I was a high school dropout, of course. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, we all know education doesn't make you smart.
Yeah, yeah. But while I was also living in that nomadic lifestyle, when I was young, I took a love to the human language and human psychology. I always called it applied anthropology, that it was the study of the way that people are interacting themselves. It was it started as a survival mechanism. Started when I had to navigate the minefield of people who were looking at me like I was either a monster or a project. Like, because 99% of the people in my world at that time, I was either something broken or something to be feared, like one or the other or both. And so I had to navigate that and figure out who I could survive off, who I could, like, it was very utilitarian in the beginning. Sure. And then I got to love mentalism and fell in love with things like Penn and Teller and the debunking psychics and that kind of thing. And the way that language can be used to construct thought. And I've always found that as long as you can construct your thought correctly, it can be extremely impactful. But you can take a very impactful thought and ruin it with the wrong kind of phrasing. And yeah, so I started really just stumbling ass backwards into this. Like, I just fell into attention and had to navigate my way to do it. I always kind of thought that I was good at this, or that I would be good at this. And then as it went, COVID slowed down and I went on Zoom. And I think that's what really kind of refined my technique, was having to do it on Zoom all the time. And you just have a one-on-one camera and a lot less personal interaction to build off in that case. And so you have to really figure out those points of integrity that you want to get through. Plus, I've had a lot of people that want to use my message for various ends and that want to kind of co-opt what I say for their own political ends. And I find it much better just to stay completely true to me. And the easiest way to do that is be as specific as possible. Like I mentioned to you before we were filming, that when I talk about mental health and gun control, the only time I ever do it is to mention how you shouldn't talk about gun control and mental health, because in my opinion, those two terms are diametrically opposed, but rhetorically very similar. That you get lost in the minutiae of the details with gun control. Is that bump stocks? Is that ammunition? Is that a rifle? And you lose sight of the actual goal of the argument, which is that you want to keep weapons that will kill people out of the hands of someone like I was 25 years ago. And same thing with mental health. It's this you say, well, we have a mental health problem. Okay, well, what does that mean? It's a big gray amorphous blob, and it's this kind of oblique thing that doesn't really have any specificity to it, but it's very individualistic, but very oblique. So you don't really have any way to see through it. And so it's just mental health. And so if, instead of saying that, I specifically have a, make a point of saying, instead of mental health, I just say I was abused and neglected and felt like I was worthless because I felt like I was nothing. And the more face I can put onto it, the more people will see a face when they see that phenomenon, because I am not a unicorn. By no means am I rare or special at all with my story. I'm just special because I want to talk about it. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of me's, as we can see by the repeated tragedies that keep on happening in the news stories. And then I see people like this Uvalde shooter that looks like a mirror image of me. Like it look, the Uvalde shooter looks like me if I hadn't been saved. That's the closest to my story that I've seen recently, where it appears, from my estimation, that he was raised in a very negative and oppressive and abusive household in the beginning, which then turned into him being toxic early on, which then caused him to be a bully, which then was responded to by him being bullied, which then made him be even more of a bully and turned him into that slide of trying to refine his ability to become a monster. If you think I'm bad, I'll show you what that is. If you think I'm evil, I'll show you what evil is. And the biggest sign was, there was two of them that showed me that made like that I'm seeing me, was that the 2 weeks before, 2 weeks before the shooting, he showed up to school with like razor marks all over his face. He sliced his face completely up. And that is the most visible sign of, hey, I'm help. I need help. Please, I'm hurting me. Like, someone help me. And then I watched an interview with his mom, and talking about rhetoric, the most eye-opening rhetoric I heard from that was her saying in an interview something about how, oh, you just don't, you don't know the hell he's been through. And I'm like, oh my God, I've heard that so many times from my abusive family. Oh, you just don't know the hell we're going through. You don't know what he's going through. Oh, well then fucking tell somebody, man, like speak up. Like that to me, that was just like, oh, that was a revelation, revelatory moment for me where I saw it was, the whole picture kind of snapped into focus with that. So yeah, I really think that, and I'm going to go off on a tangent again, I kind of rant, but rhetoric is a kind of a passion of mine, honestly. And I really feel like right now I'm fighting a rhetorical enemy.
You're always, that's all we do is fight rhetorical. That's all. That's why this is called rhetoric warriors.
Well, like, in particular,
rhetoric is always a battle metaphor.
Well, in particular, there seems to be an emerging negative social economy that is fueled by the same basic techniques that I use to attract people and to get them to open up about stuff and for activism. It's the same. I talk about how I watched that movie, The Wedding Singer. Did you ever watch The Wedding Singer with Adam Sandler? So there's a line in that movie where he's sitting with his friend at a bar, and the friend says, all I really want is for someone to hold me and tell me that I'm okay. And I really think that that's what everybody wants. And I think that at the heart of it, if you're craving that positive adulation of someone saying that you're all right, and you get it from somebody saying, you're going to be all right, but that person needs to hurt to do it, or you're going to be okay, but to be okay, you have to be the worst person, then you're going to do that. You're going to be the worst person to get that positive adulation. And I think there's a whole negative social economy where that has been happening under the surface, to the point where now there are negative celebrities and there are negative, it's just a web where they'll teach you how to be a bully. They teach you how to be the better bully and then give you points for being the best one. And then give you a social status for being for that, and give you, you get the same social credit you would get is if you were a philanthropist and you were giving away millions and you, all of a sudden you get a hospital wing. Now in this, you go and you harass the girl from Star Wars so much that she quits acting. And now you become a troll in the celebrity universe. Right. Like it's this negative, it's like a mirror world to ours. And it's entirely based on that attractive rhetoric of you're going to be good and you're going to be okay, but that person has to pay because of it. And the underlying thesis
very quickly. It. And this is one of the reasons why I like to try to teach people formal rhetoric, because it helps you organize the layout of what's going on. So you can see the categories and it doesn't all just sort of conglomerate together where you can't do anything. Mm-hmm. Like your stuff, if you take it back to Greeks, you know, I sort of, usually start with like logos, ethos, pathos, mythos.
Mm-hmm.
So mythos is your strength. You're a story, mythos and ethos. Your character, you lived this. The authenticity of your ethos is impossible to break down, to fight against. There's nobody else that I know of in the entire media landscape who was in that position, in that story, and can talk about it, especially the way you talk about it. It's a super rhetoric. That lets people bond, lets them get in there and understand it in a new way. And that's why I said, like, one of the things that I look for is how do you construct messages that are powerful enough to actually create change?
Mm-hmm.
And you are doing that. And
thank you.
Part is that super ethos that you've got. And you use story. So you tell it as a story and you have details and characters, and you do that very well. When everybody gets pulled over into logos and the logic and the information and the issue and all that, it just locks
it
up.
It does. That's the way that I would apply that. I love the way you said that. I've never heard that term before. So I would love to talk to you for hours about this kind of stuff. Is that I talk about that with in a therapeutic setting. So I deal with a lot of therapists, specifically because I have a child who had some issues with abuse with her mom and some other issues with stuff. So he had to go through his therapy himself. And so I dealt with therapy. I personally was very reluctant to deal with therapy till my early 40s, honestly, just because of the trauma of happening when I was a kid. Sure. But watching my son deal with it now, the therapist that he was dealing with, there were two distinct types. And one was the type that you were just describing, which is the project-based logos theory, where it's we have these systems we need to get you into. We have this system, these projects you need to journal, all these different things, and it would turn into white noise. You just check out completely, just absolutely check out. But then you would encounter a therapist, which would be applying the ethos technique, and it would be like, oh, so you like BTS? I like BTS. Let's go jam out for a while. And that therapist, we invite to Thanksgiving. Like it's that whole different kind of engagement. Not only do you get the therapeutic engagement, but you get to become a mentor and actually connected on a personal level and become what Mike was to me, which was an island of normal in an ocean of chaos. That kind of savior of stability of reality is a very important thing. And I've never thought of it in the ethos logos thing. So thank you for giving me those terms. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it ends up being really useful when you've got those sort of, like I said, categories to think with, you know, and it helps you organize why your stuff's effective or not effective. And, you know, the pathos element of the emotionality of what you talk about. The first mm-hmm. time I watched your TED Talk, it made me cry. I mean, I'm like, I'm watching this thing and I'm like, this is the most crystalline expression of sort of childhood and teen pain that I think I've ever heard. And you're hitting real emotional chords with people.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I the only way I can do it is just by being real. That's the only way that I can do it. This is just literally me. Like I had an interview once, I had a podcast once that reached out to me and they told me that they thought that my language was too practiced and written too well and I needed to make it sound more natural. And I was like, okay. And I gave him another bit. I literally just recorded a little audio thing and sent it to him. I'm like, here go. I'm like, no, that sounds too practiced. I'm like, this is how I talk. So if you don't like my style of speech, then maybe I'm not for your show. Like,
no, I can see people thinking, because you're articulate. You are, that's the other superpower you have. With the logos of it, you can hold information well in language. And so you're not just talking about these things and then breaking down and not being able to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the emotion and you can articulate it. And those are all really super strong rhetorician things. Like it makes you a very interesting guy in this space.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. I'm hitting a space right now. In the next month, I'm doing some mind-blowing things that, like I said, I kind of fell backwards into my life. Like I'm assistant manager at a gas station. I still work full time at a gas station. I just do this. I travel around and speak and try to help people. I was doing it kind of trying to go full time, but then COVID hit. And of course I thought I was just going back to normal. And then it just picked up again, kind of out of the blue. That CNN story hit and it just kind of picked up. And now all of a sudden, within the next month, I have three different speeches set. Two at the first one, I'm going to be speaking at a teachers convention that includes the teachers from Uvalde. That was actually set months in advance. And then a week later, I'm going out to hopefully speak to the people in Highland Park. Then a couple weeks later, I'm flying out to Florida to speak at a giant convention for law enforcement officers. And it's, if I just hope that somewhere someone can find a way out of that dark because I can help them find it. Like the most powerful thing to me is people come to me and tell me that I'm brave, and that I don't like that. To me, I'm not brave at all. Bravery is acting in the face of fear. And I don't have any fear in talking about my life. This is just me. I wasn't ashamed of me then. I'm not ashamed of me now. And the ones who I think have the bravery are the ones that then opened up to me and told me things that they think that they could never talk about in their life. And it's been literally every stratus of person. Like you said, you're a doctor. You're a professional. You've been doing things for a long time. You said when you saw me, you cried. I really appreciate that. I take that to heart. I get that so frequently from so many people. And it's literally every stratus of the population. And it tells me that we're in a spot right now that we're splitting apart at the seams. That every person, every way that we can be broken apart, we're getting broken apart. Whether it's religious or political or social or your gender or all of it, we're breaking apart at the seams. But the one thing that seems to be universal is that sense of self-loathing and self-isolation, that thing that made you cry. That thing seems to be damn near everybody. And if that is the one thing that we can see makes us people, and we can look past the barriers and drop the bullshit that we're going through, then maybe we can start healing these divides and bring us together. And if I could even have a little tiny bit of helping sew that together, then all the pain that I went through would be worth it. You know,
well, I honestly think you could have a fairly large effect on it. I think that, you know, when I look at, and I evaluate rhetoricians all the time, and none of this on my professional side, none of this, like this is just what I do. I was a Hollywood producer. I was a comedy writer. I know how to evaluate comedians, you know, and bring them to life.
If you have any connections for helping write a book, I want to get my book done so dang bad, but I have a hard time actually writing it. But I got all the stories. I could dictate a book like a no one else's business. It's just getting it actually done that's the problem. So we'll talk about that after the podcast.
We'll talk after the podcast because I have lots of resources that can help you. That's what I do. I gather, like in my entertainment world, I gather them over there. In rhetoric world, I was a professor for a long time, and then when Trump showed up and broke politics for everybody and complicated everything, I'm like, okay, let's go back into the rhetoric stuff and start, instead of teaching it to 18 to 20 year olds, let me go out and teach it to adults who can use it in their lives. And a guy like you, who is, to me, you have rhetorical assets, like in a clear, just mechanical reading it as a rhetorical producer, a rhetoric producer, you are a superpower as a rhetorician in this space. Well, I've not heard anybody in that space that has your experience.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. It makes me feel good and sad because it's hard to wrap my brain around being good at something that people shouldn't like, you know, like my story is I'm very proud of the fact that I get to talk about it now and I get to do things and like it, but occasionally my brain still has trouble wrapping around, like when I'm organizing speeches, like I have to charge, I have to pay, I have to get out there and speak, I have to get my stuff, but how do I do that? How do I tell someone they have to pay for me? Like that, to me, those are the parts where it's hard to navigate. But this part, the speaking part, the rhetorical part, to me, that's like breathing. To me, it's just I could do this all day long and it's not work. When people say that if you do a job you love, it's not work, this stuff I'm doing now, it's not work. So hopefully you're right. Hopefully I can make a big impact and find some way into that, because if I could do something like talk to Congress, I would do it in a heartbeat. I would take the opportunity. I think I'm similar to you. I'm a big fan of listening to the people who I disagree with in the spaces where they talk to themselves. So like my Spotify thinks I'm a far right extremist because I listen to all their podcasts and I listen to all the darkest ones. Like I listen to Bannon all the time. I listen to all the farthest right extremists so I could see where it's bubbling up and then see how it rhetorically goes as a chain from someone like Bannon to Charlie Kirk to Ben Shapiro to Tucker, and then it's everywhere. And then occasionally that gap shortens significantly when they have overlap. But that I think that this, the Trump era and January 6th in particular, really kind of galvanized that for me, that I really, it's very important to know what information is going around on all sides, what the different disinformation is. Because here's my theory. Tell me what you think of this as someone who's big in this space or that knows about this space. I'm of the opinion, and I don't think that it is partisan. I don't think that it's based as in a party or necessarily in a country, but I do think that there is a force or group that is entirely based around breaking this apart, that they are using specifically the technique of latching onto the things that we like to then attack us with it. And I saw it in action in some specific examples using first with the Bernie bros. We had the legitimate set of Bernie Sanders fans that actually had a want and a love for Bernie Sanders as a candidate. And they actually just legit Bernie Sanders supporters. They were latched onto and glommed onto by a troll group that was explicitly had the aim of making Bernie Sanders fans toxic to others. So they were trolling people in the name of Bernie Sanders fans. And then that, after that kind of died down and Bernie lost the public space, then do you remember there was a time called Blackout Day during the George Floyd riots, where there was supposed to be a time when everybody was quieting down and so that you weren't supposed to post anything on social media so that the heads of the organizations and the police and everybody could actually talk it out and have a discussion. Instead, this same group, I believe, then took it upon themselves to say, okay, Blackout Day means post a black square. And they specifically targeted the sites that were based around walls of pictures. And they, instead of having a day where you could quiet down and discuss things, they effectively disrupted communication, where it just blacked out everything for the day. And I think that force, again, it's not partisan. It was attacking us for a while. But right now, I think it's focused on the Republican side. And I think it's using the keywords of CRT and transgender ideology, and it's trying to hit those emotional key buttons and use the patriotism that the right seems to love so much and wrap themselves in the flag to then attack them with that patriotism to make them super toxic. Like the embracing of the far right's embracing of the anti-abortion rights thing and the potential removal of gay marriage event if they fight for that. That is so socially toxic. Like a regular person, 80% of people don't want abortion to be outlawed. Way more than that don't want gay marriage outlawed, I would be willing to bet. I bet gay marriage by now has pretty universal support among most people. And so for the far right to be currently trying to then normalize the hatred of that and the demonization of that and the demonization of intelligence and education as a whole to then stop any further addition of information into that ecosphere, it is a very dangerous thing. And I think it's based around that same force. I think it's just moves and shifts based upon whichever group could cause the most disruption right now and what do they like the most that we can use to break them with.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting theory around, you know, a lot of that stuff. And again, in rhetoric and media theory, like how, you know, negative forces come up, invasive forces. Like Trump is an invasive force. Trump is a negator. Like basically, he couldn't build an institution himself within the American democracy, but he can destroy institutions that have been around forever because they've never been hacked like this. And if you don't protect those institutions, then they're sitting ducks. And America has gotten very complacent because it hasn't had to protect any of its institutions. So they're instantly hackable. Like they're talking about the Secret Service. Like, I think he corrupted the Secret Service. I'm like, that's what he does. He corrupts every packet around him so that he can use it. You don't, mm-hmm. there are no sacred places he's not going to go. That's not what mobsters do. Mobsters go into every sacred space. That's where they make their money.
Yeah.
So
yeah, their currency isn't so much money on the other end. They're not relying on getting subservience through currency. They just want to gather the currency, but they're going to get through their subservience through dominance and strength and through
disruptive politics. And they're really good.
Yeah, yeah.
And so
yeah, yeah.
Well, and you're going to eventually. I want to talk a little bit more about your stuff because, like, some of that's going to come blowing back at you. If you start getting, you know, more and more notice, no matter who makes it into the media, mm-hmm. you become this dual target. Like yeah, you said, you're already being used for politics.
I've had that. I had a Republican make an Aaron Stark rifle raffle in Michigan. And so I've had that. And so here's a fun phenomenon. You've been in the media sphere and dealt with people in the media for a long time. I've had the approximately 250,000 messages sent to me by now. How many do you think are negative? Negative as in personally addressed to me messages, not some random YouTube comment. We all know those come willy-nilly. But I mean, someone that actually took the time to message me on any social platform and have it be negative. How many do you think I've had?
Probably very few, I would think.
Take a guess.
10?
Yep. 10. 5 of those blood related to me. And I haven't had one in 2 years.
Well, I think so.
The fun thing, here's the flip side of that. The fun thing is if you go look at my YouTube video on my TED Talk and read through the comments and watch for the amount of trolls that get converted. Watch the amount of times someone starts trolling and then 2 comments down says, I watched the video and I'm sorry. Watch that happen, because that to me is the real win. That right there is actually winning this fight, is taking someone out of that negative ecosphere and showing them, hey, I'm a human, look at me like a person and show me what it's like. Right. And see me as that. And that's the true victory right there, is being able to convert the person who saw the thing and wants to troll to get the social credit of being the negative troll and then attack the virtue signaler. And then instead end up crying and messaging me and becoming my personal friend and want to just give me everything that happened to them.
Well, and you said earlier, like, you know, how universal this is across, you know, cops and right and left and all that stuff. And it really is, you capture a very intense story of alienation and loneliness, you know, and mistreatment. Everybody mm-hmm. has been through alienation and mistreatment and loneliness. It's just not at your level. It's not as dramatic. Or they're mm-hmm. not as good at communicating it as you are. And it's not attached to this really, you know, kinetic, this really piece of lightning title that you said, I was almost a school shooter. Nobody has ever said that I know of,
mm-hmm.
you know, and especially not then be able to step up and articulate that emotionally, you know, experientially, and to give, you know, a little bit of advice for people. A little bit of a solution. There's a positivity to you that says, hey, you know, if you see somebody like this, don't just dismiss them. Find a way not to, you know, here's $5, but to be a human being with them, and you'll be surprised.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because that's what literally saved me. And now I'm a happy family man. I have 4 kids and they're my best friends in the world. And I tell them I love them so much that it's annoying. And like, I literally use what happened to me in my life and the parenting specifically. I tell my kids, I model my parenting on my own parents. I just do the opposite.
Yeah.
Whatever my family did, I just do the reverse. And it works out like gangbusters. Like, it's just amazing. My kids are well-adjusted, happy adults and happy teenagers. And it's never once in my kids' life have they had to deal with their mom hitting their dad or their dad hitting their mom. They haven't had to deal with someone scraping through the floor looking for crack rock. That is not a thing in my kids' world. And so I won, you know, and if I can win, someone else can too, because I have met people who have went through worse pain than I have. And then I also see the fact that, so here's something I've been discussing a lot recently in my interviews. You've heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so that's where at the very base, you have to establish your base survival. If you can have food, shelter, then you can have a want, that you want something. And if you can establish a want, then you can have a dream. And if you could dream for something, then you can have an aspiration. And so it's like this ladder that you go up. It goes up to a point. Okay. Now take that and flip it on its upside down. And you start off with this wide plane, and then it goes down to a point. All right. At the point at the bottom, that's pain. Pain and self-mutilation, self-immolation. That's the bottom of it. That's pain. As that tree grows, it expresses itself differently as on each branch. And depending on the stimulus of the person involved, it's going to express itself differently as they grow. Men and women express it differently based on their gendered stereotypes that we've grown up with. Men are tend to be taught that it's all about be a man, have a stiff upper lip, that violence is currency when you're growing up. The stronger you are, the more you can hit something, the more popular you are. You could be ugly, you could be dirty, you could be smelly. If you can break something, you're still going to be all right. That was one of my problems, but I was also not that when I was growing up. I was the one that got picked on and beat up all the time. So I didn't have that at that aspect for me either. But if I'd had that, maybe that would have been something I would have latched onto. Might have been even more destructive potentially. But that violence that we have as men can then explode as rage and as hatred. Okay. As for women, that can go more inward and go more towards introspection, because their bullying tends to be that way. The female method of bullying tends to be that, oh, you didn't wear that way. You don't look that right way. You slept with that guy. It's all personality based. It's all a personal attack on you, and you're not good enough. And so that can express itself as more degradation on a physical external level, where you are doing things like having eating disorders or being addicted to porn, things like that, like expressing yourself in negative ways. I'm not saying porn's negative. Porn's fine, but just it can be toxic.
But we don't want to take shots at porn. Way. I mean,
huh? Yeah, yeah. I don't want to demonize porn or sex workers whatsoever. That's do your thing. Do your jam. But it can be toxic to have to lose yourself and your self identity in that kind of sexual expression. I've seen it personally. The toxicity of it can happen, and that kind of expression, I really feel that there's no difference at the heart of it. And the pain that I was feeling in my worst point when I was about to kill a lot of people, and the pain that a model feels when she's in her car throwing up in a cup before a photo shoot, that at the heart of it, it's not any different. Outwardly, it looks vastly different. Two branches of a tree, totally separate. But it's still self-loathing and self-degradation. It's still, I'm not good enough. And I'm actually of the theory, here's a tangent I never talk about. I think that makeup is an example of that, just as a whole. I think the existence of makeup as a thing is an example of men telling women for a long time that they're not good enough and making it to where now they think they have to wear that and it's just natural. And again, not attacking any woman that likes to wear makeup, do your thing. But I think the reason why you even think that that's a thing that exists is because men for decades or centuries and millennia told you that you needed it and you weren't good enough as yourself. And that not being good enough is a really intense struggle. And that's why I really think that when you're, it can be such a cathartic thing and so humanizing to show someone that they're a person when they don't feel human. When you feel like you are nothing and you're your bottom, to have someone look at you and notice like, oh, you're actually okay. You're not really that. You're not the broken monster everybody else sees. That you're going to make it through this pain. And that I tell my kids all the time now that the only thing constant in life is change. The only thing absolutely certain is that tomorrow is going to be different than today. And it might not be better and it might not be worse, but it is going to be different. And so we have a choice in that matter. We can either adapt with those changes, or we can either resist those changes and get worn down with the waves of those changes like rocks on the ocean and just get beaten down into pebbles. Or we can adapt with those changes and turn into the water ourselves and just flow. And so it's all up to us with the choices in life that we have. And so I feel that now if I can help someone else find that spot, that's my rhetorical goal. That's what I think. If I can impose one thing from my message into everybody, is that the best thing you can do for someone is to look at them like, if it really does come down to as simple as what they would say in the Bible, walk in someone else's shoes. You know, like I'm very much atheist, very out atheist. I personally don't even believe that souls are real. I think they're biological processes we don't have identification for yet. But I find a lot of common ground and a lot of common messaging with the messaging of Jesus Christ himself. Like, outside of the Old Testament evil crap and the stuff leading up to in the Bible that's all has a lot of negative connotations to it, the actual messaging of peace and love the outcast, wash the leper's feet, you know, that we've lost that as a people. And that's why it surprises me sometimes that what I say is surprising to people. Like, it's if you were to ask Mike, why'd you do what you did? Why did you treat him like that? Why did you treat him like a person? He literally would say, that's what a friend does. That's his only answer. So.
Yeah. No, I think there's so many things embedded in your story, like the gender thing that you just pulled up about. The one other thing that I think it's powerful about your talk is that this is a masculine male issue. The shooting thing is males. And it's like you said, it's taking all those same feelings, but expressing them in a violent, homicidal, as opposed to just straight suicidal way. And, you know, it's not very often you get men expressing hyper masculine pain in a way that other people can understand, you know. And I think you express it in a way that other people can understand, like, oh, I see why he wanted to do that. You know, like, it's usually just a big room of confusion. Why would anybody ever do that? And you've given some explanation to it that lets people then move to a solution, you know, which I think you do nicely too. You give people a decent, you know, solution, something they can act on, which is, hey, reach out to some of these people and check in, because if you don't, you know, they just get worse and worse, and they're going to find some way to express it.
Yeah. We have to do something. Like, I think that right now we've been in a big problem in our country with, in every aspect of it, where the perfect is the enemy of progress. If we don't have a law that'll fix everything, we're not going to do it. If we can't find a gun control law that's going to fix everything, then we're not going to fix gun control. If we can't find a law that's going to stop all the people from doing school shootings, then we're just not going to bother with it. And instead, we focus on making sure that we have indemnification and all the adults don't have any liability. And we try to do panacea solutions, where we do stupid things like hardening the targets at schools and arming the teachers, which are just two of the stupidest solutions ever. Anybody that ever hears me will always hear me say that. Those are two stupid things to think about, because first off, hardening the targets. Let's take that one. You're going to limit it to one door. Okay. Well, let's take all the morality out of it for a second. Let's look at it tactically. If you're attacking a spot, you're attacking a spot with a lot of doors that are leading out of it, everybody's running out of all the doors, they might have a chance to get away. You're attacking a spot with one door, everybody only come out one door, then maybe you don't go inside. Maybe you sit outside the door. They're going to come outside the door. So what did you do? Like, what was why did you even bother with that? Like, it's a stupid thing to do. And then giving teachers guns. I've talked to a lot of educators, especially doing what I'm doing now. I get the honor to talk to a lot of educators, a lot of doctors, a lot of counselors in schools. Not a single soul who teaches in school that I have interacted with wants to carry a gun to shoot a student in the school. Not one. These people want to raise the kids and learn how to love them. They spend more time with them than their parents do every single day. They know the kids better than their families do, and they have more interaction with them than their families do. And they expect these teachers to carry a weapon and kill the kids. Like, that's just, while at the same time, ignoring the things like, all these kids just said, this kid over there, he's been hurting himself a lot. Maybe you should listen to that kid who's hurting himself a lot. But they ignore those warnings and say, well, you know, we have liability, and if we report these things, then maybe too many people will get involved, and, you know, we'll focus on hardening the school. And
the solutions are where the problems, you know, it's where the solutions become politicized, and they become, you know, multiple interests and all that kind of stuff.
Especially when the easiest solution is literally just acknowledging the person's existence in pain, letting the person know that I see you, you're a human in pain. That's it. I've had the privilege of, I started a Facebook group from my experience called You Are Not Alone. Okay. And in my Facebook group, it's up to about 3,000 members now all over the planet. And it's full of people who are looking for support in this area, and also has a bunch of actual doctors and therapists and clinicians and stuff, just as people, so that if someone has a post about something, they can talk to them as a human and not have those trigger warnings and trigger responses that you immediately have to report because someone says something when they're venting. Because I think that we have indemnified ourselves in the language area too far to make critical therapy viable. Because when you're in that critical spot, it's important to let the person who feels like they're going to explode express that without using violence. But if you go to a clinical setting and you sit down and say, I feel like blowing up the world, first thing you do is get cops at you. Right. When maybe all you wanted to do is say that what these are the thoughts in my head. You know, like it's, there has to be some kind of middle ground. And I've had the opportunity in that group to the group itself. It's not me. I can never take credit for this, but I'm so proud of it. I mention it all the time because it's a group effort. The group itself has become a positivity machine itself. And that has prevented over 30 suicides. We have early on, it helped prevent 3 school shootings in other countries. And it's helped multiple kids leave white nationalism. And we've done that by that acknowledging the person, the I see your pain, I see the damage you're in. And then if it gets too hard, activate the authorities and try to and get the response. Because it's important. One of the things about acknowledgement that people don't get when it comes to dealing with people in depression is not just about saying everything's going to be okay. It's not about that. That is glad handing. And that can be just as counteractive as anybody else. You can lose all your effects if you're doing that. The goal is to connect on a human level. So say, do things like, I see you, dude. Do you want to have a meal? But feeding is important. Connecting over food can be so cathartic. It's the small things. Because when you're in that dark spot, the small things are all you have. And so you really are just establishing Maslow's hierarchy. You're establishing that floor that you can exist right now. And we'll be okay. Like you can eat, you can watch a movie, you can exist, you can tell me what you enjoy. What do you like as you? That's another question people don't tend to get asked a lot, especially when you're in that dark spot. People are like, oh yeah, what do you get away from me? It's never, what do you enjoy? What do you like doing? What do you like about this? You laughed at that. What do you think was funny about that? Like that kind of engagement, they never get. You never get that when you feel like you're alone. And to have that connection, when it is so powerful and so easy to do, if you can do it. Because if you can't, then you just become white noise like everybody else. You just turn into one of the people that look you like a project or like to be feared, and you lose all your thought. So it's being able to connect like that has been the key. It's the people who have reached out to me. If you give me more than hi, how are you? I give you me back. I'm just a regular guy, and so are you. And so just like the barriers that exist, I think we should break down. I think that we, as a society, we built up a lot of social stratification where we have this person's an influencer, that person's a doctor, that person's an authority figure, that person's whatever it is. And it turns into this sectioning off of people that you think that people can think that someone is socially unattainable. Like, I can't talk to that person. They'd never listen to me. Who am I? Who's going to listen to me? And being able to remove that barrier is the most vital thing. Listen to people. Listen to the ones who think that no one's listening, because they need someone to. And it will help you too. It's cathartic on both ends. It'll help the person who listens, and it helps the person who's being listened. It is a positive sum game.
Yeah, I think, you know, I could talk to you for a long time. I don't want to wear you out too long. We're at an hour.
I'm good. I can go as long as you want to. I'm fine. We can keep on going if you want to. Like I said, I could talk about this for a while, so I can go another little while.
Well, I'm interested in like I said, I'm a producer, so when I see things and I think they have value for the society or for people or for issues like this, I want to help nurture them. I want to, you know, see what I can do to take you from, you know, sort of doing this on your own. Like it starts with Facebook posts and your friends, and then it moves out, and then you start getting into the media, and then you're like, there's an option for you, I think, to be produced professionally without losing the authenticity and the power of what you do.
And I would, if I could ever get the opportunity to not work at the gas station and just do this and help people, I would just
I'm going to help you figure this out. So I'm sitting here in Hollywood. We need to get you an agent. Like, do you have an agent?
No. I had a speaking agent in the beginning, but she was not very professional, and it just
you're gonna run through lots of people like that. I'm gonna get you hooked up professionally with a Hollywood agency that's going to do personal appearance stuff for you, and I'll help you produce your stuff. So like,
should we talk about this off air? Huh? What's that? I said, should we talk about this part off air?
This is what I do professionally. I don't care. Like, there's such good work that you can do in this. I want to help you. I want to produce it so that you can make money at it, pay for your family, and it can go really big and really.
I would love that.
That's my feeling when I hear you.
I would love that. And relish the opportunity. Like, it's the things that I'm doing now are I've been walking around all day long tingling. I'll talk to you off air about the biggest thing I got coming, because oh my God, it's kind of mind blowing. But there's been any chance that I can get to, like, it for me, it's two levels. Like I said, it's hard for me to think about charging for it, but I also want to provide for my family. I got four kids, and if I can give. I live in an apartment, and I work at a gas station. And if I could I do
an hour of comedy, and I get $3,500 to $5,000.
Yeah,
for comedy, and it has no value outside of comedy. So when you have value about something, you should get paid for it. It doesn't matter if it's just you talking about your life. You've got a unique life, and you it's not just you. It's not just I'll live this. Then you are very articulate about it. And that communication value, that communication clarity that you have is rare.
Well, thank you.
Right now it's rare. So you should be able to do this.
That might be why, because I felt like it's weird that all the reporters I talked to keep on telling me that recently too. Like, you're really good at talking. You're very good at this. Like today I had the honor of this morning I was interviewed by Michelle Martin, the host of All Things Considered. And she was actually interviewed me for Amanpour and Company. It's airing tomorrow on PBS and on CNN International. So they actually did a full half hour interview with me. And that was, as far as like professional interviewers go, that was the first time I was interviewed by somebody who their entire life spend interviewing politicians and really, really important people. And it wasn't just a 5-minute hit, you know, like I've done a bunch of small ones. I did Katie Turr. I was on MSNBC. Like, she's interviewed politicians and stuff too. Like, that was big. And I was on Kyle Clark, and that's cool. He's local news, and he's really big for local, but it's local news. So no slight on him at all. But this was the first time that like, I felt like I'm able to get past just the novelty of my story now and get into the meat where I really can dig into it, which I really just am loving. And so it was like, I told my story in the beginning of it. And then she dug in a way that interview and this interview, honestly, are two of the best ones that I've had in quite a long time, where it dig into things that I didn't think about before and look at it in different ways. And afterwards she gave me that compliment. She was like, you are extremely well-spoken, and I hope we're going to do this again more. And I'm like, that's amazing. Like, thank you. It's been a dream. So yes, any opportunity I can have to help to jump onto that train, I will. Yeah, it's been, and that's another thing. I'm kind of rambling, so sorry, but it's recently I've been coming to grips with the fact that I've actually put in work at this. Like, I was just talking to my wife about that the other day, because I kind of fell ass backwards into it. So for the beginning of it, it was just, well, I got another news thing. That's cool. Check that out. I'm doing that thing. And then I look back and I'm like, wow, I've done. I did a TED talk. Wrote my own Washington piece. Did you read my Washington Post article?
I did not.
Yeah. I got to write a 5,000 word piece for the Washington Post.
Oh, send me that.
Yeah. And in one day, I had stories in on Fox, CNN, MSNBC, NBC, and Time Magazine, and they all were positive, including the comment section.
So are you making money on this?
I am. It's not as much as I think I should be, because I'm, like I said, I'm having a hard time with doing it, but I'm averaging about 2,000 to 3,000 a speech.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I could
get to 5,000 a speech and do that like twice a month, I would be a very, very happy guy.
Yeah. I think I've been in professional communication forever, so I'm perfectly at home and at peace with people making money for their stories and their ability to communicate and things like that. That's what it should be.
Yeah.
And I think you've got a unique thing that you've done, and you've got social capital sitting there, social good that you can do in the world. You should also have capitalist good. You know, why not? There's nothing negative about it. It just needs to be produced. Like when you do those appearances, which are, I mean, who gets that opportunity, right? Those are massive media exposure. It should draft back to your book and to your videos and things like that. So that your family does get taken care of.
I wrote the first half of my book, but I kind of lost a lot of it. I need to rewrite it. It was just in chunks as I was going through my story. My wife said, you need to write this as a book. And so I was kind of trying to, but it was just hard to actually put pen to paper and write it down.
Yeah. You just need a development editor to help you with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I have all the stories. If I could get someone that I could tell the things to and they could write the book with me,
somebody who might do it with me. So I'll check with her.
Yeah. Cause that's
what I've done. I've got all this collection, this big constellation of professional communicator helpers and stuff. And I bring it to bear for people, and especially people like you, I think should, like I said, you have a lot of social good sitting there and you're a good human being. And
I really appreciate that. It's an honor I don't take lightly. I got the chance yesterday to spend an hour talking with one of the moms from Sandy Hook because of this now. And she lost her 6-year-old in Newtown. And I don't take this lightly at all. This is an honor and a privilege that I will. This is what I should have been doing forever. Do you ever feel like you step into your dream world? I feel like at the beginning of it, I told my wife, like, I felt like the universe handed me a giant silver platter and says, here's everything you ever wanted to do. Would you like to take it? And it was really frightening at the beginning because I had to adjust whether I was going to talk about it with my family and with all that kind of stuff, just on their level. Like coming out with my story, I wasn't fearful for me, but I was fearful about what might happen with my family. Cause like you said, my title is rather controversial and a little bit shocking. And so when someone sees it, I get polarized reactions until you watch it. Right. When you watch it, it's a different thing, but until you watch it, like it was costing me jobs. It was like literally like day jobs, because I would go apply I've been working at the gas station now for 2 years. But before that, I had just come out with my story and I was working at a place and lost that over something stupid. Was trying to apply for a job. And I have, and like in Wayne's World, I have an extensive collection of name tags and hairnets. So in the food industry, I usually can walk in and get a management job like right away. They want me to hire on. So I've avoided that industry for years because I don't want to do that anymore. But I went out and applied at the places that I'm like, all right, I need a job. I know I can go work here. And nobody was hiring me. And I'm like, they're not even giving me calls back. Like, what's up with this? Like, my resume is stellar in this area. What's going on? And come to find out, one of the managers is like, oh yeah, I Googled you. Like, I'm not talking to you, dude. I don't want the old school shooter in my store. I'm like, did you watch me? Like, did you see? And I just happened to go to a store where the manager clicked on the video after I left. And because the first thing they do is Google your name.
Right.
And so they happened to click on the first video after I left and they called me as I was walking home. They're like, oh yeah, yeah, come on back. We just cried watching you. Come on back. We got you. Okay. And so that again happened to break through the stereotypes. That's why my whole journey is based around that whole thing. That if you see me, you see a big, scary, angry, hairy guy. But that's not me. Right. I am a family man who loves comic books and video games and comedy and knows more about superheroes than any human really has a right to. And so that's
no, that's great. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll do another one of these down the road a little bit. After we get off, you can tell me more about the professional aspects of what you're doing, because I'd love to help you. And yeah. I super appreciate you jumping on, man. Like I said, your story is super powerful. And when I run into people that have coalesced that kind of stuff in real space and are getting attention and doing good work with it, I want to talk to them. And so super fun.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Yeah, well, I'll tell you a bunch of cool stuff right after we get off, because I got some cool stuff.
Awesome. So. Well, cool. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. This is Aaron Stark. Go find him online. Go watch his videos. He'll have other stuff out. Just an amazing story and a really good guy. And I am Dr. Dan.
If you want to find me, come find me on Twitter at StarkDad1313.
Okay. Yeah. And I seriously mean it. Watch his TED Talk. And don't try not to cry. I dare you. it's very touching. And so get out there and persuade some people. That's we all need it. And so get good at it. See you next time.